Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, 7 nanometers and 128 cores. This is going to be a fast CPU. AMD Ryzen 5 2400G build. Should you spend more for faster memory? Logitech MX Master 2S, a mouse for pros, not gamer, and so much Qualcomm news, including Qualcomm's always connected PCs. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 454, recorded February 22nd, 2018. Qualcomm drops all the news before Mobile World Congress.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by IT Pro TV, the fun and entertaining way to sharpen your IT skills. Visit itpro.tv/twitch and use code TWITCH30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most affordable, most expensive, most delightful, most disturbing, and just generally the most hardware news and reviews we can bring you each and every week. Mobile, desktop, we're here for you. I'm here for you. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrouts. How are you, sir?
I am excellent. How are you today?
I'm sorting as I'm moving to a new office location, which means finding boxes full of cables that I haven't needed for years, but of course will need in the next 196 hours if I throw them away today. I mean, that's how you told me, because I'm looking at this as a big chance to divest myself of you know, hardware that's not previous generation, but like previous generation. I'd like to get down to, you know, nothing older than previous or previous generation hardware. You said you had a really easy fix to this. You moved to a larger place and just put it on a different shelf.
Yes. Rather than do any kind of organizational or like cleaning or purging process, I instead put them into boxes and plastic containers and moved them into a different spot.
So if I need like a FireWire 400 cable, I'm going to call you. Or maybe I should call, you know, Alan.
Well, you can call me okay. And I will say, yes, I definitely have one of those item X things. And then you will say, okay, can I have it? And I have no idea where it is. But you're welcome to come look, right?
That's the one I was waiting for. There are several flights into Cincinnati from the West Coast every day, yeah. Patrick. You can get on any one of them and route through our hardware reserves here at PC Pro. Oh, my goodness. So big news last week, AMD Ryzen. AMD brought back the APU. We talked about the benchmarks on the Ryzen 5. And Ken went nuts, right? Because the Ryzen, so one of the things it's kind of tough if you want to build an AMD Ryzen system today is that there's no, on the mainstream or the performance AMD Ryzen processors, there's no graphics cores. So you can't just be like, well, I'll just use the onboard graphics until someday when the GPU prices have dropped 70%, I can afford one again. You can't really do that. But what you can do is if you want to do something sort of mid-price, you can go with an AMD Ryzen 5, like a 2400G. And those actually pool the system memory and the graphics memory. So Ken's question is, it worth the money to upgrade to faster RAM? Because, of course, RAM has gotten more expensive in the last 18 months. Is it worth the additional VIG, the additional charge to move to faster RAM? Is there a definite performance reward to that? Yeah. And what was Ken's findings?
The results are definitely noticeable, right? That first result there that looks at 3DMark, basically there's four configuration tested. The bottom one is the 2200G, the slower processor with 2,933 megahertz memory. But if you look at the top three, you've got basically the same CPU tested at 2400, 2933, and 3200 megahertz memory. And you see the graphics performance scales from about 3200 to 3600. a 13% jump for, let's see, 8% for the first jump, 13 to 11% for the second jump. And obviously you combine that and you're getting something around 20% in total increase by moving from what we would consider the base level performance of 2400 to the higher performance memory at 3200. And if you scroll through the results, he does some testing in Ashes of the Singularity, Dirt Rally, Ghost Recon Wildlands, Civ 6, those types of things. And it's a pretty consistent performance increase, right? You know, when you say you're going from 20 to 23 frames per second, that's not great for that particular test. But in terms of a percentage, in terms of a relative shift, that's actually pretty impressive. You look at something like Dirt Rally 1080p, you're going from 45 to 52 frames per second simply by changing and upgrading the memory speed.
I mean, we should point out, like, it is a significant percentage, but maybe not so much that you're actually going to enjoy the difference in performance. I mean
in that, I think in that 52? Specific instance, right. In that specific instance, you may, you know, like the 20 frames per second example, you would probably lower your image quality settings a little bit more to get into a more playable state, obviously. But if we're talking about 20% performance delta, it's going to be better, right? And 20% is going to be something you can feel. If you're going from mid 40s to low to mid 50s, you know, you're basically in and out of that. You're out of the area of stutter or tearing more frequently than you would be otherwise, for example. Or in another case, you may be, you know, if you adjust settings, you know, for example, in Civ 6, we go from 61 to 69 frames per second, almost 70 frames per second. So now you're maybe jumping from a spot at with the lower speed memory where you are going above and below the 60 FPS mark fairly frequently, mm-hmm. which gets you into this weird stutter profiling type of thing. Whereas maybe when you're hitting 70 on average, you never dip below 60, and it would make a significant impact on the actual user experience, even more so than the 12 or 15%, you know, scaling might indicate. So there's a lot of other things that go into play in there. The other data point that we ran through was single channel versus dual channel. Mm-hmm. This was interesting just from an educational standpoint. If you look, those top two metrics, that's the 2400G processor running with a single DIMM of memory versus the same processor running with two DIMMs. And you can see the score drops from 3600 to 2200 when you take out that DIMM. Now, for a DIY, for an enthusiast, a desktop machine, it's unlikely that we would see anybody do that. But if you remember back into the long, long days ago of 2017, where people were building budget PCs, there was often discussion about using a single DIMM instead of two DIMMs in order to save money.
Hardware Secrets, I mean, it's a couple of years old now, but Hardware Secrets did a really interesting, pretty deep dive into looking at dual channel memory and if it actually made a difference in gaming performance. And in that... since it really didn't do a lot. Now, of course, that's 2 years ago. They actually found, quote, in some cases, there was actually a performance drop when the dual channel mode was enabled. It was interesting to see, like, because you always think, like, you know, dual channels, like, got to have all that bandwidth. And sometimes it doesn't impact it, but in this case, it did.
Yeah, and this behavior is more unique to the AMD side of things, especially when you look at integrated graphics, right? So the integrated graphics on an AMD processor greatly changes performance profile from single channel to dual channel, or even memory frequency, as we see here in the story as well. Intel's integrated graphics does not scale in the same way. It just doesn't. They just have a different bottleneck on their internal systems compared to what AMD could do, you know? You know, the interesting thing when you brought up pricing at the beginning is memory is expensive no matter what speed you're looking at. You know, when we were first doing our testing of the 2400G, there was a noticeable difference in performance between the 2400 and 3200 megahertz memory. However, I think as we published this story, it was down to maybe $20 or $30 difference between getting 8 or 16 gigs of 2400 versus 3200. And if that's the case, you know, that price delta would probably tell me that, yeah, you should probably just pay for the added memory speed, get that added performance. Although, even all that being said, the idea of paying $180 for memory for a $180 processor to then use integrated graphics seems off-putting, but only because prices in general are just so high. There's no alternative for this platform. There's nothing anybody, AMD or any other consumer, would be able to do about it until one day in the magical future when memory prices don't suck so much.
In the magical future. Oh, my goodness. So a few months ago, I took a look at Logitech's MX Ergo, which is their first new trackball design in like 10 years. And the biggest thing about that was you could actually adjust the angle of the trackball. As ridiculous as that sounds, is going to that 15-degree angle can make a huge difference in comfort for a lot of people. Now Christopher Koch up on PC Per has looked at the Logitech MX Master 2S for creatives and professionals. And it's kind of interesting to look at because we took a look at Contour's Unimouse this week on Tech Thing. And there, you know, it's nice to see. It seems to be there's I hesitate to say swell, but more than a few non-gaming oriented mice coming out this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And in particular, you talked about the trackball. I talked about this one. We should also point out that it's not that you cannot game on these mice. That's just not their targeted audience, right? They have slightly different controller configurations, slightly different, you know, mouse button and ergonomic configurations for that. But it still has like a nominal DPI of 1,000 and, you know, it goes up to 4,000. It's got really high battery life. They claim up to 70 days on a single charge. Realistically, you know, Jim here in the office has been using one for a while, 2-3 weeks of a lot of use, right? Continuous use. But the buttons and the feel of it may not be ideal for what your gaming purposes are. Also, it's a little bit heavier than a typical gaming mouse would be.
Well, I was gonna say also gaming mice have certainly a lot of the latest generation gaming mice that I've played with. They're definitely going for a while. It was like, we're going to give you this really heavy mouse to make it easy for you to sort of, you know, snipe at things and move per pixel. And now it seems to be the lighter, the better, no matter how plasticky the end result is.
Yeah. Yeah. You're also not going to find any RGB LEDs on this mouse, which is a positive or a negative. You can see at the bottom, it actually has support for three different connections. So it supports Bluetooth as well as the 2.4 gigahertz wireless adapter that it comes with, which is actually convenient if you travel or you want to take this mouse to multiple devices or on the road. You know, you pick it up from your desk, turn it off, put it in your bag, wherever you get your laptop, you hit that button that cycles between PC 1, 2, or 3, and it'll connect, you know, to pre-configured systems that you've already set up. So that's kind of nice. Right. And because of that really long battery life, you don't have to worry about the fact that, well, I mean, it charges through micro USB, so the chances are you'll have a micro USB cable with you or will have access to one anyway. But overall, good mouse. It's $100, which is not cheap. But has a lot of, I mean, if you look at like the thumb area, yeah, there you go. The thumb section, it's got a thumb scroll wheel in addition to the standard between primary two mouse button scroll wheel, your standard forward and backward buttons as well. And it's just kind of, built and sculpted for that productivity style or, capability. It does also support Logitech Flow, which is, the software that allows you to control multiple PCs with a single mouse, by magically, if you just move your mouse cursor away from your screen up to the, you know, and across the virtual space to your other screen, say your laptop on your desk, it will just start working with it based on the focus of where the mouse cursor is. And if you have a keyboard capable of that configuration as well, the keyboard will work wherever the mouse cursor focus is as well. And it actually works pretty well. Pretty neat little feature. Probably the number of people that have, you know, two machines at the same desk or a PC and a laptop that they're often using at the same time is lower. But it's a super nice feature to have that doesn't require to use VNC or install any kind of weird drivers or have two physical mice sitting on your desk as well, which is pretty frustrating.
Well, it's kind of a nice overlap with, okay, you know, I'm a professional or I'm a, you know, I do this, I do that. I'm not necessarily looking for a gaming mouse.
you know, the people who can use that, whether it's sysadmins or somebody else, are probably excited about that. Much like I was excited about the trackball. Most of the people I work with looked at me like I'd lost what was left of my mind.
Qualcomm signs major carriers and retailers for always connected PC launch. I am of mixed feelings about this, right? The always connected PCs with LTE. As somebody who constantly uses their laptop with their phone, you know, I should be more excited about the idea of a Windows 10 box with you know, an LTE modem built in. But the flip side is this is essentially a Windows 10 on Snapdragon, which I am worried about. A, because, you know, I'm doing things that require a lot more performance than the average user, and B, there's always the sort of question about compatibility when you start having multiple processor lines under Windows. Now, this is not going to be the Windows RT experience part two, thankfully.
No.
You know, it's not going to be like you're going to buy this laptop and in 6 months no software will work on it. At least it doesn't have the same barriers to entry in terms of software running on it. What do you think? I mean, you know, who's going to be using these? Obviously, I mean, I think like major enterprises, like, you know, in like groups of insurance adjusters and hospitals, and, you know, do you see these doing well in the retail space, in the consumer space, or are these mostly going to be in the corporate enterprise?
I think they'll start in the consumer space. I think the corporate enterprise is actually an area where they would have more concern over custom applications or custom drivers or VPNs or any kind of virtualized setup that may not function with the Snapdragon version of Windows at the outset, sure, right? So that's probably something that will minimize some of that. I look at this as either targeted more for consumers that demand battery life and connectivity, or small businesses that don't have big IT management departments, or they know they're using, you know, Microsoft services or Google services or whatever anyway. So, you know, they're basically based out of a web browser type interface. I think the application support is there. It's growing, and they have the emulation layer for the 32-bit apps. The announcements, the new stuff that's being discussed at Mobile World Congress next week is basically that Qualcomm knows where they're going to sell these at, where HP and Asus and Lenovo are going to sell them. In the US, it's going to be at Microsoft right. stores and Amazon.com. Nothing at Best Buy, which is a little bit disappointing because you do want to have that big, popular, you know, mini outlets across the, you know, nationwide right. Retail where you can get your hands on it. But, you know, I think probably from a traffic driving standpoint, Amazon will be more than enough for what this first wave of devices will look like. They've also announced, though they announced that all four carriers in the U.S. are going to support these devices, these carriers have not yet announced what their pricing or plans are going to be for this. And that's still something that's a significant question, right? Is, yeah, I can, right. I can put in a SIM card into this device and I can put it on my Verizon plan, but what are they going to charge me? Are they going to charge me, you know, $80 a month to add it as an unlimited device like I do my smartphone? Right. Are they going to charge me $25 a month and limit me to 5 gigs, or what's it going to be, right? And that's, I think, a critical part of the story, because while I think more people than most would imagine will be interested in having a device that you can just turn on and use, and you don't have to worry about if you're within reach of a Starbucks or not, the fear is, hey, Windows PCs tend to use a lot more bandwidth than smartphones, just inherently, right? You've got Dropbox right. installed, or you've got Google, you know, or you're streaming video and it's not limited to 480p like right. on your smartphone. Those types of things could add up pretty quickly.
I had a conversation with Sasha Sagan about this from PC Mag, and I flat out asked him, like, you know, do carriers no longer care about people that are consuming large amounts of data? And he's like, no. In fact, they don't want it. You know, they talk this big game about how the plans are unlimited, but what they do is, you know, you pay for, like, you know, 15 gigabytes a month, 20 gigabytes a month, 25 gigabytes a month, 5 gigabytes, whatever it is. And then at that point, they cut you down to a minimal amount of bandwidth, or have the option to cutting you down to a minimal amount of bandwidth. So let's say 128K.
which is fine if you're, you know, just doing a little light email and stuff, but is a nightmare if you actually have to transfer data. And you can no longer, if you are on one of the new plans, you can no longer buy like an extra 5 gigs of data or 10 gigs of data. They don't want a whole lot more traffic on their networks. And if they, you know, if you do want more traffic on the network, they are going to make you pay for it in a pretty painful manner. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of, it feels like Qualcomm and the carriers, you know, either the carriers are going to shift towards being more enthusiastic about large data users, or they anticipate this being a wonderful source of revenue. You know, it's a little early to tell, but we'll kind of see what happens with that. I don't have a lot of high hopes for there being tons of affordable plans around these laptops, unless Qualcomm's spending a bunch of money.
No, and I don't think that's the case. But I it's a constant battle between what the carriers want and what these, you know, technology providers are creating, right? And that, even if you take the Windows on Snapdragon devices out of it, if you just look at tablets, you look at large screen phones that have HDR, 4K displays, I think, you know, there's a tug of war that is happening where people have growing expectations about what quality of content and capability of content they want to get to their device. And the carriers are fighting back and trying to find creative ways to monetize or to increase infrastructure. And, you know, we could go into the whole FCC stuff and whether or not that helps or hurts everything. But I don't think... I don't want anybody to try to or think that it would be better to not release these types of devices and force Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile to have to make a decision, right? Because that's what you want. You want one carrier to make the wrong decision and two carriers to make the right decision so that you can go use those, support them, and then force the other guys to follow along with you, right? So whether or not that happens on a reasonable time frame, I don't know.
We wait with bated breath, as we often do. Man, Windows 10 on ARM details. Scott Show wrote this up. So Paul Thurrott found the developer documentation page troubleshooting x86 desktop apps on the Windows Dev Center, Scott writes. The goal of the page is to list a few reasons why the software you develop might not be compatible with Windows 10 on ARM and the WoW translation layer. Yep, they're reusing that name, which was the translation layer for 32-bit Win32 applications running on 64-bit Windows. So we'll keep quoting Scott here. Based on this document, we now know that Windows on ARM will not translate x86 drivers, just x86 apps and services. Does not support 64-bit applications, Thurrott said they're working on it. Does not support hardware-accelerated OpenGL 1+1 or DirectX 1 through 8. And Vulkan is not mentioned anywhere, but I'm guessing not. You know, application can't modify Windows components. For example, the 7-zip entry in the Windows File Explorer right-click menu unless it is recompiled for ARM. Hyper-V is not supported in Windows 10 on ARM, which kind of makes sense. You know, there's a lot of software out there that will run just fine. You know, OpenGL is going to be interesting because at this point... it's kind of curious that there's no OpenGL support on these processors. And this is all, by the way, not for you know, universal Windows applications. It's for, you know, Win32 applications to get them to run on ARM processors. If you have a UWP app, it should work on all the things.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of feeds into the whole, you know, enterprise customers with custom apps or people with what I will affectionately call fairly obscure applications who are looking to make sure they actually run when they get the thing.
I think there's still some questions to answer here. Alan brought up last night, like, hey, what about printer drivers? How is that going to work? Is Microsoft doing some of this translation at all? Or is it completely up to everybody to find HP and Canon drivers compiled over? And how will that look? Because that's something that, you know, in terms of drivers, Qualcomm is building the drivers for the CPU, the GPU, the storage, all that type of stuff that they're creating in the SoC and in the platform. But when you start attaching other devices, you know, I know for a fact that, you know, USB 3 displays work. You'll be able to daisy chain those displays. Anything that functions in that way will still be able to work. But there are still some questions to iron out. I think not having OpenGL support is interesting, considering how prominent OpenGL is in the Android space. And obviously Android support in the architecture is really there. It's either, it's just obviously either, it's either Qualcomm or Microsoft's responsibility to build that driver for Windows for that GPU. It just hasn't been done yet. And apparently, you know, these devices are going to be shipping mid-March. I think HP had a pre-order go up on their site for its device with the March 9th ship date. So people will have these in their hands very soon, and there won't be any more mystery about it.
There may be surprises, and there may be pain, but there won't be much mystery. I don't know. You know, having gone through several iterations of operating systems with new printers, is it, I think it almost entirely depends on who the printer manufacturer is, because in so many cases, you know, the older a printer is, the less likely they are to care, and printers tend to be the sort of forgotten peripheral in migrations like this. Not to sound negative, but don't be terrified and frustrated if suddenly your new laptop doesn't work with your old printer. So much sadness. You know, it's not sad. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by IT Pro TV. Sharpen your IT skills and empower your team with IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV offers over 3,300 hours of binge-worthy on-demand training with more than 125 hours added weekly. It's a lot of content, people. Stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide. They don't care what you want to watch on. They support it all. Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC. You can use their iOS or Android apps. There's no need to go offsite for training. If you got a desk and an internet connection, if you got a phone and an internet connection, you can be learning with IT Pro TV. They do IT Live every day, so you know you're getting the most current IT training. Courses include CEH V9, CISA, SQL Server 2016, Azure 70-533, CCNA Security, CompTIA+, and more. Track your team's results, improve the return on investment of your training spend with IT Pro TV's supervisor portal. So if you want to know what the crew's doing, you got that. You get full control over your team's training schedule. You can create custom groups and training assignments, view logins, viewing time. Yeah, Jimmy, you spent 2 hours yesterday. It's not showing up. Whose login did you use? Video downloads and course completion tracking. You can get to see individual and group analytics. Check out their team solution for group pricing so you can get everybody covered so you don't have a nightmare of, you know, figuring out the other thing, the cost, the receipts. James Packer. You know, he used IT Pro TV to train himself and his team. He got recruited to his dream job in a literal tropical paradise. The more you know, the better you can do, the better you can do. I bet the happier you'll be. If you're interested in learning more about IT Pro TV's team solution, contact them for a free team trial, including their supervisor portal at itpro.tv/twitch. Or sign up for an individual monthly membership and a free 7-day trial at itpro.tv/twitch and use code TWICH30, that's TWICH30. You'll receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your active subscription. Join the more than 90,000 IT Pro TV members today. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Transcender practice exams and virtual labs, are normally $857 a year, but you only pay $600 when you go to itpro.tv/twitch and use the code TWICH30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI proven. We want to thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, my goodness. Thunderbolt 3 SSD, the Rapide 480 gigabyte Thunderbolt 3 SSD. Is it TechQ? I have difficulty with that name.
I don't know the answer to that. I think you're probably right.
Because Tech sounds so better than Techqua.
Oh, yes, for sure.
So Thunderbolt 3 has been a disappointment for a lot of people. You know, it's like I want faster backing up or moving of files for external storage. What did Ken find when he got the benchmarks rolling on this shiny silver drive?
Pretty much all positive things, right? So it is as fast as any external drive we have seen. It seems to utilize the entirety of the PCI Express 3.0 by 4 interface, which is pretty unique. It is small, compact, right? About the size of the business card. and, you know, does 2.7 gigs per second read, 2.2 gigs per second writes, or higher, right? We did a, you know, simple file copy transfer, talking about almost a gig per second in Windows, moving over single large files, you know, did the Mac speed test and saw similar 2.1 gig read, 1.2 gig writes. It's fairly simplistic when you take it apart on the inside, right? You got your control, you've got your Thunderbolt controller, you've got, and then you've got an M.2 port on the back that is sporting a generic, probably reference Fizon SSD, a 480 gig SSD. Did ship with a Thunderbolt cable. Now, this is a Indiegogo project. It's not actually for sale right now. I think if you look at the pricing for the 480 gig model, the quote unquote early bird price is $383. And then they say after the crowdfunding campaign will retail on Amazon for about $450. So it's not like super cheap. That's not what they were going for here, but they were going for an external drive that actually matched or beat the specifications of everything else out there. And they actually did a pretty good job of doing that. It's a simple device. It's an M.2 external drive, Thunderbolt 3, 480 gig, but it does exactly what they say it's going to do. And normally we don't cover a lot of, you know, Kickstarter, Indiegogo campaign projects, but this is something that they were adamant about, had lots of emails back and forth about it being ready to ship. And they had this one ready to go to send us to test. And they're supposed to start shipping April. So relatively quickly.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, given that I'm still waiting several years later for my 3D headset to see an action.
Sure.
This is also kind of a, you know, this looks like a, you know, a pretty simple enclosure, and they mm-hmm. got the drive and everything running on that one. So something to be said for simplicity.
Looks like they're going to offer a 960 gig model as well for $719. So, you know, you're paying a little bit of a premium because it is a small run product, because it's external. But in terms of other external drives, it's actually pretty competitively priced, mm-hmm. and also is much faster than what those are providing in almost every case. So
we like faster.
If you're looking for a speedy little external drive that you can use on your PC or Mac, there you go. Now you got one. At least you might have one in April. How about that?
That's a good thing. Raven Ridge delidded Deer Outer post AMD Ryzen 5 2400G before and after video. There is an ardent enthusiast community that believes that the lid on your CPU is preventing maximal performance because it doesn't have good thermal transfer between the top of the CPU, the chip, quite literally. And that that piece of metal that keeps you from shattering it because you screwed up. How did it go with the overclocking? Sebastian wrote this one up, but I'm looking at the Raven Ridge delidding. In terms of stock temperatures, it seems like it's barely a couple degrees or a couple seconds.
Yeah.
Core temperatures like 2 degrees with stock clocks and delidded. 7 degrees, looking at like, 6 degrees. I'm comparing the wrong parts of the benchmarks. Like I'm looking at like Cinebench versus, stock, delidded versus undelidded, and it's maybe a 6 degree drop. That right there, stop right there. That's the tool that basically cracks the cover off your processor. When you get that open, you find out there's you know, thermal paste inside there. Mm-hmm. Is it this seems extreme to me. I mean, I don't want to sound
it is wimpy. Here's yeah, I mean the interesting technical aspect here is the Raven Ridge APUs use a standard thermal interface material as opposed to a soldered interface between the die and the heat spreader. The reason that's interesting is because all the first generation Ryzen parts used the soldered version, which is better than a thermal interface. And it's also interesting because Intel in the last several generations of its processors, including its high-end enthusiast parts, has not gone the soldered route and instead gone with a less expensive, easier to manufacture thermal interface route.
Okay.
So two things. One, people were worried that this was an indication that AMD was going to follow the same route, that they were going to do thermal interface standard TEM across their product line going forward. They have since come out and said this is only happening on this part because it is a budget processor, low cost, that the future Zen Plus processors, the Ryzen 12 nanometer parts are going to be out later this year, will still be using a soldered interface for that, which is good. The experiment here is interesting, though, that this overclocker went through, because you can see the drops in thermals are actually kind of impressive, right? If you look at Prime 95, which is a worst case scenario, it drops from a 65C to 53C after it's been delidded, soldered, and put back together, right?
Okay, so basically I'm not looking at the best case scenario for the results. Because
go ahead.
I was just saying, because the results on the page we were looking at, like, I've seen, thermal paste deliver similar, and thermal paste generally doesn't deliver a huge spread, but like a bad thermal paste job, will give you 3 or 4 degrees. Bad to a good thermal paste job will give you 3 or 4 degrees. And a decent cooler will easily give you 6 or 7 degrees. So,
absolutely, absolutely. And so what you're looking at is the top graph is at stock clock, the bottom graph is at overclocked settings. So if you look at overclock settings with Cinebench, you see a 10 degrees Celsius drop with this process change. And in Prime 95, you see, 15 degree C process, temperature drop. That's actually really significant considering you're using the same cooler, and all that type of stuff. What is disappointing is that even with those temperature drops, he was only able to get 25 additional megahertz of overclocked frequency out of part, indicating that, AMD didn't make a bad decision going with its standard TEM, because both it saved money and changing it would have affected temperatures, but wouldn't have affected their, peak clocks or performance scaling or anything like that, really, based on this sample of one, I guess you could say. But interesting to look at nonetheless. I think what people are justifiably, there has been a lot of people that complain about the fact that Intel does not use a soldered interface between the heat spreader and the CPU die. And the reason is because if you look at that most extreme example of the overclock settings going from 79 to 64 degrees Celsius, 15 degrees Celsius for an overclocker is a significant amount of temperature, especially considering that a lot of these recent Intel parts were hitting thermal thresholds when you're using triple radiator coolers and stuff. So it's not that there isn't a space for improvement on the thermals of some of those things. The Raven Ridge part, the Ryzen parts are not that. They don't need the temperature delta that this supplies, but it's a good kind of before after on another architecture to really kind of make the case of the advantages that the solder can have over TIM. But I don't think, especially on a $100 processor, $150 processor, you should be going through this process, both because it's a lot of effort. Obviously, it's risky. Some of the tools that they've created for this, like that, what looks like a moderately sized torture device, is actually a heat spreader removal. They're relatively safe as you can get tearing off a piece of your processor. But the vast majority of people should not and will not ever do this. So. Also, the idea of pulling a threaded bolt right across the edges of the pins of your processor is kind of unnerving as well. But what are you gonna do?
What's the worst that can happen? You spend 2 or 3 hours of your life trying to straighten out 50 or 100 slightly bent pins so you can actually use your processor again.
Right.
Like you've never done that already.
Absolutely not.
Oh, my goodness. AMD Epic Rome Rubber, 7 nanometers, which is incredibly small, 64 cores, 2 designs. These, of course, are server processors. And the big deal here is AMD is talking about stuffing 64 cores, 128 threads on a single processor die. And, you know, as Scott writes in the article, this is probably due to the process shrink, right? You're going from 14 nanometers down to 7 nanometers. Quote, this is not the same as the upcoming second generation Zen processors, which are built on 12 nanometer and expected to ship in a few months. Rome, he writes, is probably not coming till 2019. This is, if you know, if you're doing big servers, big iron, you know, if you need all of the cores for whatever terrifying things you're doing in your cluster in, of servers, this is pretty crazy. You know, one design will have 12 cores per die, 448 cores per package. The other have 16 cores per die, 464 cores per package. This is, you know, this indicates that AMD thinks there is a huge market for this. Pretty crazy. You know, I mean, 128, all I can think is like, you know, I know Premiere won't take advantage of it. Handbrake won't take advantage of it. But boy, don't you like the idea of rendering video with 128 threads?
Yep. Yep. Sounds pretty compelling to me.
Are these $1,000 processors? Will these be $2,500 processors? I mean, you know, they seem epically expensive.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this to me is that part of the epic Ryzen spiel that AMD went through over and over again was that they saved money and design time by designing one die. That die had 8 cores on it. They used 4 of those die, to sell 32 core processors as Epics, 16 core processors as Threadrippers, 8 core processors as Ryzen, and then down the stack. Now they're saying they're going to, if this rumor is true at least, they're going to have a 12 core and a 16 core per die option, which is why, you know, you multiply that by 4, you get your 64 die or 64 core systems. I would expect, because the process node shrink and because it's, you know, 2 years later, that we're probably talking about the same price points or very close to what we're at today. So think, you know, $1,000 for whatever the Threadripper equivalent will be, $500 for the top Ryzen 7 equivalent will be. And I would expect that you would see, you know, 16 cores instead of 8 cores in your Ryzen 7, and you would see 32 cores instead of 16 cores in your Threadripper, and you'd see 64 cores instead of 32 cores on Epic, which I'm a big fan of for, you know, reasons you were just talking about. Hey, video encoding on 128 threads sounds great. But AMD needs to continue to differentiate their product from Intel, put pressure on Intel, and find ways to offer things that Intel hasn't done yet. Now, it's possible that Intel steps up their game within the next, you know, calendar year. They're offering, you know, competitive parts ahead of time instead of trailing, but we'll have to see. But I am incredibly interested in, as we progress down this field, software still has a long way to catch up, right? We still need games to take advantage of more threads, more applications to take advantage of more threads. But nobody can say at this time that the hardware guys aren't doing their part. So... should be interesting for 2019.
It should. Oh, man. Qualcomm introduces True Wireless Stereo Plus and broadcast audio. Mobile World Congress is around the corner. And so these are, as Sebastian writes, enhancements to their True Wireless Stereo technology, which is a good thing, right? Because there are a lot of phones coming out without headphone jacks. And... I sigh because I'm not the hugest fan of hearables at this point, but essentially they're looking to enhance the audio experience for earbuds and hearables, especially the one that's going to be built around Qualcomm's QCC5100 Bluetooth system on a chip that was announced at CES 2018. Quote, this update to True Wireless Stereo promises an easier pairing experience with no need to pair individual earbuds, along with the ability to autonomously role switch each earbud between primary and secondary roles in order to balance power consumption more evenly between the buds for longer playback time. And as ridiculous as that sounds, you know, what they're basically talking about is dealing with one of the big problems with truly wireless earbuds, which is connectivity and performance. One of the reasons I was told in secret from a vendor is that the AirPods shipped late was because, you know, making stereo work between two unconnected, non-connected, disconnected earbuds is actually much more complicated than people give it credit for. So this is interesting. You know, if you are hoping that the you know, the audio gets better, it's a plus. The other thing that's crazy is the broadcast audio. So Snapdragon 845s will be able to allow one Bluetooth device, such as your phone, to stream audio to a whole bunch of headsets or speakers with, quote, near perfect synchronization. And if they can pull that off, that is a non-trivial feat. I'll be very curious to see how that works in the real world. So, you know, or you could send it to multiple speakers. You know, your friends could listen to the same music. They also, as technology companies do, tend to put things out more on the fringe. For example, a guide can speak into their phone and their voice could be relayed via broadcast audio to the headsets of a tour group. Assuming, of course, all of the headsets in the tour group are owned by people with late generation phones and have the appropriate equipment in there. So, you know. This integration will not be limited to the Snapdragon 845, writes Sebastian, as devices using the new QCC5100 system on a chip, as well as others in Qualcomm's range of Bluetooth chips, will support broadcast audio. So, you know, I'm curious. I'm curious to hear some of the next generation. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Most of the sort of most of the wireless earbuds I've heard have been mediocre. Some of them, Google, have been downright awful. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens as more of these are made and maybe more people that know what earbuds can sound like when they're done well start manufacturing them. So hey, we'll see. We'll see. The other thing that was interesting is Qualcomm announcing the 845 mobile VR reference platform, also ahead of Mobile World Congress. So essentially it's, you know, we are going to do another cool self-contained ARM-based headset. You know, think of it as a cousin to any of a number of devices that are on the market now. Adreno 630, which is the graphics upgraded compared to the Snapdragon 835. You know, is there going to be enough of a, you know, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, they're talking about graphics performance upgrades, like 30% foundation or 30% power savings, which is actually a pretty huge deal. And then eye tracking with Adreno foveation, which is a phrase I hope to say very little in the next few minutes. Well, you know what I mean? It's like, and this, of course, you know, they're doing the 6 degree of freedom thing that was coming out from several vendors this year on the Windows, you know, the Windows VR platform. You know, is there going to be a significant improvement over existing Snapdragon 835s? I love the idea that there's going to be significant power savings, at least on the graphics. But, you know, are we in a VR rut at this point? As we wait, Okay, sorry.
Well, I was going to say it's not just the power savings on this, because if you think back to the 845 performance metrics that Sebastian published last week or 2 weeks ago, we saw like a 30% improvement in graphics performance and 30% improvement in CPU performance going from 835 to 845. So there is a pretty significant performance uplift for gen-on-gen movement here. So I do think that platforms that integrate 845, of which this announcement is just that there's a reference platform for it, in the same way that there was an announcement for a reference platform of 835 previously, it's actually still a good sign, right? The rut we're in with VR is more around the stalling out of VR on the PC side, where the performance is actually capable of doing a whole lot of really interesting things, and the fact that mobile-based VR was just in a very different performance category. And it still is, but you're going to see more improvement to the wire, like cordless mobile form factor VR headsets in the next 3 years than you are on the desktop side. I still believe that will be the case. So what you'll see is, you know, while Lenovo and HTC and Oculus have all announced platforms based on Snapdragon hardware, I imagine we'll see the same thing from them, you know, maybe come E3 or something to that regard. They'll see VR headsets announced based on this platform, which I don't think will drive significant more excitement because VR is now, it's now a thing. It's not going away, but it's also not, doesn't have the rapid acceleration and excitement that we saw when it first came out. But it will be iterated on until it again comes to a point where some massive portion of the audience tries some new workload or some new game or some new capability and goes, oh yeah, no, I get it now. Like, I get it again.
Right.
So 845 is the step on that. I don't know if it is the conclusion to that. But it's definitely a faster product that will give you more battery life, run cooler, and provide a better platform for software developers to target against as well.
All right. Anything you can tease coming up on This Week in Computer? No. We know what we can tease on This Week in Computer. Anything you can tease coming up with PC Purr for the audience today?
Let's see. What is this? He looks around. I got some wireless accessories from Corsair in. So keyboard, mouse, lap board, type thing that I'm interested in seeing how that works. If you remember I can't remember the exact name of it, the Corsair device that was for gaming on the couch, right? Mm-hmm. The problem with that is it still required USB 3.0 connection back to the PC. Now we have a wireless version of all of this that I think will be pretty interesting. Also, we got in the new Dell XPS 13, rose gold, of course. So I am interested to get some hands-on time with that as well.
You know, the more cores are awesome. We got a backup special coming up next couple of weeks on Tech Thing, TekThing. If you have a question about backup, whether it's 3-2-1 backup, backup devices, building your own NAS, you know, cloud storage, any of those good things, do us a favor, email ask@techthing.com, and we'll pick up on that in the show. And other than that, you know, I got dead computers to fix and, you know, seventh generation old GPUs to try to figure out. In some cases, people gave me stuff. I didn't even know they sort of slid it onto my desktop. And I'm like, what? Why is this?
Yeah, that'll here? Happen.
Yep. So if I do fly out to your space, I will I'll be sure to slide
leave
a few
anything
treats.
Behind.
Yeah, only no, if you catch
me. One of the
me,
rules we have is fair.
I'll just wait till you're in the bathroom. They'll just start sprinkling stuff in different boxes. You don't know what's in the boxes. Prove that I put it there.
It's true.
Yeah, you know, my big goal is to reduce. I'm getting all of the cables that I don't have an immediate use for into a single container, and I will edit those before they go home because there's. Nice. The last purge I had, I was, you know, sitting there, I was like, is that no, you know, like it just some of the cables you find, it's like, why that cable is 18 years old.
And you spend way too long looking at them and thinking about where their source was and what their usefulness was rather than just throwing it away, what you should do so you can actually be productive the rest of the day. I do that a lot.
Somebody humming the memory song in your background. Da, 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 da. I won't finish it lest we get taken down or something. With that, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, a.k.a. Twitch. You can find more episodes, all our episodes, in fact, at twit.tv/Twitch. You can contact @RyanShrout. That's Ryan Shrout on the Twitters. And you can find me on Twitter @PatrickNorton. And, of course, you can find Ryan at PCPer.com, an excellent source of hardware news and reviews. And you can find me at TechThing. And if you're into the home theater and audio lifestyle or headphones, do me a favor, go check out AVXL.com, which is a show I host, a podcast I host weekly with Robert Herron. Apparently the dust in the warehouse is getting to me because I'm starting to sniffle again. So I'm going to sign it off. Thank you all so much for listening and sharing this show with your friends. And with that, I'm Patrick Norton.
Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.